Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, January 14th, 2024. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo. From the front page of today's Gazette, proposal upends Iowa education agencies. Under Reynolds' plan, AEAs would focus only on special ed and districts could opt out. By Grace King and Tom Barton of the Gazette. Iowa's area education agencies that provide expertise to educators and families would be prohibited from offering services beyond special education for students, and school districts could drop their current agency and look elsewhere for the services under a bill proposed by Governor Kim Reynolds. The Republican governor said the changes are needed because the state's 9 area education agencies have grown beyond their core mission of serving students with disabilities, and some have become bloated and ineffective since they were created in the 1970s. But still leave districts without choice but to pay for them anyway. Over the last year, in dozens of conversations with parents, teachers, school administrators, and AEA staff, it's become clear that while some of our AEAs are doing great work, others are underperforming, Reynolds said during her annual Condition of the State address Tuesday night. We have superintendents who won't use their services but are still required to pay for them. She said the results are troubling, with Iowa disabled students performing under national averages. She promised her bill would not reduce special education funding by one dime. Her proposal, filed Wednesday as House Study Bill 542, however, has created more questions than answers for leaders of area education agencies and school officials who are concerned about which services currently offered might not be included as special education services under the bill. The proposal is much more drastic than we anticipated and will have a major implication on services to kids, said Nathan Wood, chief administrator of Great Prairie AEA, which serves about 35,000 students in 14 southeast Iowa counties. About 70% of funding for Iowa's AEAs currently goes to support special education services. The agencies also meet schools' needs in media and technology and educational services, including math, science, and literacy, which could be on the chopping block under the governor's proposal. AEAs would no longer be able to provide experts to school districts as they make curriculum decisions, support in implementing new curriculum, mental health support, services for students learning English as a second language, and technology and cybersecurity services, among other things. The way the bill is written now, there will be consultants who are experts in math, science, literacy, behavior, and computer science that would be unemployed, Wood said. Margaret Buckton, a lobbyist for Urban Education Network and Rural School Advocates of Iowa, said overhaul isn't a strong enough word to describe how the bill would affect area education agencies. Boy, I hope they take their time and find out what parents of students receiving services and community members value in the AEA structure and not make changes flippantly, she said. Earlier this month, when a gunman opened fire at Perry High School in Iowa, killing a sixth grader named Amir Jolliffe and wounding 7 others, Heartland AEA responded that day with a crisis team, sending 50 school counselors to be available to families, students, and staff. Amy Knupp, executive director of special education at Central Rivers AEA in north central Iowa, said the bill could eliminate the agency's ability to have these crisis teams. They're not getting recognition for all the work they've put in, said Knupp, who has been in touch with Heartland AEA leaders since the shooting. We're boots on the ground every day, Knupp said. We know the parents, we know the teachers, we know the administrators, and we're out there working hard. Literacy support is at risk under the proposal, Knupp said. Students who don't qualify for special education but struggle in reading would no longer be able to access AEA literacy experts, Knupp said. Let's develop a plan together, Knupp said. Decisions being made without anyone coming to talk to us and see what we do really is a disservice. Yes, we always want to improve. Help us to do that. Another outstanding question is whether the bill would allow early access services to continue. The AEAs offer supports to families that are eligible with children from birth to under 3 years old. Parent Michelle Elgin began receiving services for her now 17-year-old son from Grant Wood when he was 6 months old. Elgin's son has cerebral palsy, a motor disability that affects his ability to move, and a brain malformation. He's not able to walk, talk, eat independently, write, or type, she said. He's required a lot of assistance and therapies over the years, Elgin said. Grantwood AEA staff came to the Elgin house when he was a baby for a free developmental assessment. They provided her son with a stander, which supports a child in standing, to aid in his hip development. Over the years, Elgin's son has required assisted technology like mobility aids, screen reading software, and speech recognition software to learn. She worries AEAs might not be allowed to continue offering some of these services, even though her son qualifies for special education under the proposed law. AEA chief administrators say these expenses could fall under technology and education services, services that would be cut if the bill passes. It can take trial and error to figure out which device is best to support the learning of students with special needs, Elgin said. In the Benton Community School District, where Elgin's son attends school, there aren't any other students using devices like the one he needs to learn, she said. The AEA was able to provide dozens of options to Elgin before the school district purchased the equipment, which can cost thousands of dollars, a potentially prohibiting cost for some districts and families. If the AEA is no longer to provide these services, where does my child get the free, unrestricted education he is promised by the state? Elgin asked. At Grant Wood AEA, which serves seven counties, including Lynn and Johnson, nearly 60% of agency staff is assigned to specific schools as part of a regional team. They work directly with children and educators. John Speer, chief administrator of Grant Wood AEA, said the agency is not afraid of efficiency, but changing the structure of the agency so quickly can lead to a disastrous outcome. We try to be better every day, Speer said. If you're going to change a system as embedded in school districts as AEAs, you need to take more time with it and engage a broad base of people to make that change, including lawmakers, AEAs, educators, parents, and families. Officials with area education agencies across the state said the bill, if made law, would mean about a 30% reduction to their staff. I think it would negatively impact all schools because of the upheaval and discord it would cast around the whole system, Speer said. I don't think districts, regardless of size, can replicate the services we offer. Our staff are nervous, Speer said. They know they do good work and they're valued by school districts, but they don't feel valued right now by the governor. Doug Wheeler, superintendent of the College Community School District in Cedar Rapids, said 4 months, the legislature hits its 100th day and possible adjournment April 16th, is not enough time to make a really responsible decision about a system that has been in place for decades. Teachers in the College Community School District receive mentoring and support in managing student behavior in class from the AEA, Wheeler said. Lisa Breitfelder, superintendent of North Lynn and Central City School Districts in eastern Iowa, said that Grantwood AEA's curriculum consultants work closely with teachers to recommend a new literacy curriculum the district adopted this year. AEA staff are now helping to implement the curriculum. Central City Science curriculum is supplied by the AEA and assists with the school's technology needs. The governor's bill was published Wednesday in the Iowa House. Republican leaders, as of Friday morning, had not yet scheduled the first hearing on it. Under current law, Iowa school districts send their state and federal fundings to special education to one of the AEAs in their region and then rely on the AEAs to provide special education services to their students. Instead of funding funneling through the districts to their AEA, the districts would be given the option under Reynolds' proposal to keep that funding and allocate it for special education services as they choose, at an AEA or at a private company. If schools like the services from the AEAs, they can continue to use them, Reynolds said. If they want to use a neighboring AEA instead, they can do that. Or they can go outside the AEA system, contract with a private company, or partner with other districts to share a speech or behavioral therapist. Or they can spend more on special education teachers and put the dollars right into the classroom. School districts would have to let the state know by April 30th, as part of their annual budget certification process, whether they intend to continue relying on the AEAs for all their special education services, or whether they intend to retain the special education money and decide where to spend it, according to the governor's office. If choosing a private company, school districts would be responsible for ensuring they are abiding by federal law in teaching students with disabilities, and the Iowa Department of Education would check their work to make sure providers are providing fair and appropriate public education to students with disabilities, according to the governor's office. Grant Wood AEA employs about 100 speech-language pathologists serving more than 50 schools, both public and private, in its region. While this would be considered special education services, the proposal could lead to schools competing with each other for services if they opt out of their AEAs, Speer said. It would be less efficient, take more staff, and be more expensive, Speer said. Speaker of the House Pat Grassley told reporters after Reynolds' condition of the state speech Tuesday there would be an expectation that special education services would still be provided, but he wanted school districts to have freedom to allocate resources and money as they wished. I think there's going to be more of a want to give that flexibility to school districts, and I think you'll have the ability to be creative with some of the flexibilities that it sounds like will be in the governor's bill, Grassley said. Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, Republican Grimes, echoed Grassley. You're looking at giving school districts the flexibility with that money to do what they want with it, he said. Democrats said they were skeptical and wanted to see details. Senate Majority Leader Pam Yoakum, Democrat Dubuque, whose late daughter received special education services through AEAs, said she was concerned the proposal could disproportionately affect rural areas. I know a lot of families with special needs children are so dependent on those services, Yoakum told reporters after Reynolds' speech. It sounds like we're beginning to privatize even the area education agencies. Mike Baranek, president of the Iowa State Education Association, the union representing public school teachers, called for continued support of area education agencies, noting the help of the Heartland AEA after the Perry shooting. Our public schools need more resources to help foster positive and inclusive school climates. They don't need weapons and fewer educational professionals in the building, Baranek said in a statement. Turning to the Iowa Today and the Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state, under the heading In the News, Iowa caucus could be the coldest ever. A blizzard swept through much of Iowa on Friday, dumping several inches of snow across the state and making travel conditions treacherous into the weekend. Parts of northwest Iowa had received up to 11 inches of snow by Friday, with wind chills projected as low as 40 degrees below zero. The weather comes just before Iowa's first-in-the-nation Republican presidential caucuses, which are set to be the coldest in modern history. Presidential candidates canceled events in areas of the state Thursday and Friday, as weather made travel impossible. Turnout will be a key factor in Monday's caucuses, as candidates with the most dedicated supporters may see an edge due to the weather. Democratic leader passes on re-election. Iowa Senate Minority Leader Pam Yoakum of Dubuque announced this past week she will not seek re-election this year. Yoakum, a Democrat, has served in the legislature since 1993, and she was Senate President in 2013. She became the Democratic Senate leader last year after the sudden ouster of Senator Zach Walls, Democrat Coralville. Iowa Chief Justice wants higher pay for judges. A staff shortage across the spectrum at Iowa's courts is challenging the judicial system, Iowa Chief Justice Susan Christensen told lawmakers during the annual Condition of the Judiciary address. She said investments are needed to attract court reporters and contract attorneys, and a salary boost is needed for judges as applications for vacancies are falling and Iowa judges make well below those in neighboring states. Reynolds unveils tax plan. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds made her tax cut plans official this past week, promising to accelerate and deepen tax cuts that Republicans passed into law in 2022. Reynolds said the cuts reflect Republicans' conservative budgeting principles and are a response to the government over-collecting from Iowans. Under Reynolds' proposal, Iowans' income taxes would set to a flat 3.65% starting this year, retroactively to January. In 2025, Iowa taxpayers would pay a 3.5% income tax. Democrats have opposed income tax cuts in the past, saying they disproportionately benefit the wealthy and do little for low-income Iowans. Judge strikes gender balance requirement. A federal judge ruled that a law requiring Iowa's State Judicial Nominating Commission to have an equal number of men and women is unconstitutional. The law, like similar laws requiring a gender balance on Iowa's board and commissions, was passed in the 1980s to address gender discrimination and the lack of women on the board. GOP candidates make final pitch. The four leading Republican presidential candidates held dueling media events Wednesday in a competition for attention and eyeballs days before the Iowa caucuses. In a televised debate, Nikki Haley painted Ron DeSantis as a liar and flip-flopper, while DeSantis said Haley was influenced by Wall Street and corporations. Donald Trump held a town hall with Fox News at the same time. Under the heading, They Said, one of the best ways to honor the community of Perry who just endured this shooting is to come up with policies that will make it so there's not another school shooting. Iowa House Minority Leader Jennifer Combs, Democrat Windsor Heights, on Governor Kim Reynolds' legislative agenda. And let me be absolutely clear, the surplus does not mean that we aren't spending enough. It means we're still taking too much of Iowans' hard-earned money. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on proposed tax cuts. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Ag Gag upheld. A pair of so-called ag gag laws in Iowa, which create penalties for people who trespass on agricultural property intending to create financial harm, are constitutional, a federal court ruled last week. The appeals court found the laws are not overly restrictive of free speech. Regents funding. Governor Kim Reynolds proposed a $12.3 million bump to Iowa's public universities, less than a third of the increase the Board of Regents requested from the legislature. The proposal amounts to a 2.5% increase over last year. Under the heading Water Cooler, CO2 Pipeline, after attempting to pass laws for 2 years limiting the eminent domain power of carbon capture pipelines, lawmakers supporting the restriction said last week state action was unlikely. Instead, they suggested a court challenge could be lodged if a state board approves an application from Summit Carbon Solutions to build a pipeline across the state. and Perry shooting victim remembered. Hundreds of people said goodbye Thursday to 11-year-old Amir Jalef a week after he was shot to death at Perry High School by an older student who also wounded seven others before killing himself. Perry residents packed a Catholic church and spilled over to a nearby church where the funeral was televised. Turning to the Insight page, we have a guest column from Barbara A. Trish. She is a professor of political science at Grinnell College, and this column originally appeared in The Conversation. Ground Game. Trump's Iowa political organizing this year is nothing like his scattershot 2016 campaign. Donald Trump is doing something new in Iowa. The state is home to the first-in-the-nation GOP nomination event, the Iowa caucuses, which take place at 7 p.m. Monday. Trump, the former president, holds a resounding lead over his rivals. What's new for Trump in this campaign is actually old stuff, a throwback to traditional caucus campaigning. I've observed Iowa caucus campaigns over eight cycles, and in my 2022 book, Inside the Bubble, offers a close-up of the 2020 Democratic contest. Against that backdrop, it's clear that the former president is taking cues from those who've come before him. The widely accepted path to caucus success, first paved in 1976 by then-unknown Jimmy Carter on his way to the Democratic nomination and eventually the White House, is to organize, 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 as many campaign staff will tell you. Since then, it's been the mantra for candidates of both parties, and this year, that includes Trump. But such attention to organizing is a shift for the Trump campaign. Today looks nothing like the scattershot campaign from 2016, the only other time Trump has waged a nomination battle in the state. A caucus in Iowa is a first step in a series of events that will ultimately select delegates to the national convention that formally nominates the presidential candidate. Unlike a primary, in which voters go to a polling place and cast a ballot, a caucus is a political party meeting at which people discuss the candidates and then vote. Caucuses are held in each of the approximately 1,700 precincts in Iowa. Registered party members can participate in the caucuses, and attendees will signal their support by writing a candidate's name on a piece of paper. Organizing isn't unique to Iowa caucus politics, and it means different things depending on the context. In electoral politics across the U.S., campaigns organize by doling out responsibilities to field staff positioned across a state or electoral district. These staff then amass volunteers to get out the vote either on election day or, in some states, in an early voting window before the election. A typical organizing effort in caucus politics identifies early supporters of a candidate and asks them to be the foundation for a larger volunteer structure. These volunteers engage in outreach to other potential supporters, sometimes in person, via door-to-door canvassing or on the phone, and increasingly by sending text messages. They'll make sure that known supporters get assistance they might need to get to the caucus, such as a car ride. The personal element of organizing is well-suited to caucus politics, which poses unique challenges to campaigns. Like primaries, caucuses are within political parties, so voters can't rely on cues, like party labels, to pick a candidate. Instead, a friend or family member volunteering for a candidate just might be persuasive. Trump's nod to organizing is noteworthy and is at odds with his brand, which is more focused on stirring the pot and agitating, rather than painstakingly building back infrastructure. Back in 2016, reluctant Trump volunteers, unfamiliar with caucus procedures, courted Iowa supporters. And while the headquarters of rival candidates were abuzz with activity, Trump's was deserted. Trump came in second in that year's caucuses. Now, Trump's 2024 field army of some 2,000 caucus captains, many of whom have already gone through formal training, are the frontline recruiters in the lead-up to this year's caucuses. They carry out tasks on behalf of the campaign at events themselves. Lest this all seem overly staid, there's bling, too, a limited edition white and gold variant of the distinctive MAGA cap for the captains. Of Trump's GOP rivals, it's Vivek Ramaswamy, the young biotech entrepreneur new to politics, is working the hardest to meet Republican activists face-to-face. With a schedule packed with town hall appearances as many as 8 or 9 daily, Ramaswamy is on the Pizza Ranch circuit, taking advantage of the community rooms in the Iowa-based restaurant chain with a Christian conservative corporate vision. Trump's caucus events are different. They're large rallies with hundreds in attendance, and since mid-October, most of them are billed as commit to caucus events. The events have considerable time devoted to instructing the crowd about how to caucus, which is an unusual use of time at campaign events. It's also a little perplexing, but potentially conveys some meaning. The typical rally requires attendees to register and be in place well before the event begins, perhaps 1 to 2 hours early. Attendees are primed with a playlist and some B-list endorsers. They have included a losing congressional candidate, Trump's former acting attorney general after he fired Jeff Sessions, and the Iowa attorney general. Despite Trump's commanding lead in the polls, local GOP stars like Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and prominent Iowa evangelical leader Bob Vanderplas are on Team Ron DeSantis. Last summer, Trump's campaign scored a big win in California, where it successfully pushed for Trump-friendly processes in that state's winner-take-all presidential primary. Whether simply finding ways to modify rules to his advantage or flat-out rigging the system, this new Trump approach is time-honored. And it just might give Democrats even more cause for concern. A second term might be fueled with a little more political know-how to advance the Trump agenda. Althea Cole writes in her To a Candid World column, "In Linn County, some Republicans may be shut out of caucus. The big day is finally upon us. As I have many times now, I'll be leading my local Republican precinct caucus Monday evening. It's one of my very favorite political activities. One thing about my local county caucuses has me worried. Based on instructions from county party leadership, it seems possible that some Republican caucus-goers in Linn County could be turned away from full participation in their precinct caucus. I hope that doesn't happen. I fear it will. Precinct chairs and caucus site leaders have been instructed by Edward Bernie Hayes, former state Senate candidate and current chair of the Linn County GOP, to monitor the number of people arriving at each caucus site. If the number of attendees looks to near capacity of the area in which caucus activities are to happen, precinct chairs and site leaders have been told to cut off entry, even if those still in line meet every eligibility requirement. We will not let them in, okay? Said Hayes to the Linn County Republican Central Committee at its December 14th meeting. We will not let them in because it's a safety issue, and we have a contract that says we can't exceed that number. The contract to which Hayes was referring for the caucus site at Kirkwood Community College, but his directive was for all caucus locations. But what we're proposing to do, Hayes continued, because many people come simply to vote. They may not want to be interested in the precinct committee business and all that stuff. We're going to go down the line, as long as they're in line, say, here's the cutoff at 7, these people are in line, and we will register them. We will look at their ID, and we will give them a ballot and let them vote. And we will take their ballots and bring them with the others, but we're saying, hey, you can't enter the building because we've exceeded capacity. So we're going to let you vote. That's all you get to do. I understand and appreciate the attention to safety. Republicans who caucused in 2016 at the convention center in downtown Cedar Rapids might remember being packed body to body with hundreds of others outside the caucus hall with no room to move while waiting to check in. It was dangerous. Nobody cares to experience that again. But denying entry to perfectly eligible caucus goers simply because of a building's prescribed capacity? That's a scale on which safety and participation don't seem to evenly balance. For most caucus goers, cutting off the line might be no big deal if they're at least given a presidential ballot. Of the many thousands of GOP caucus goers during a non-incumbent presidential election year, almost 187,000 in 2016, the vast majority attend only to vote for their preferred presidential candidate and take off once that's done. Many, however, stay for the remaining caucus functions. That's what makes a caucus different from a primary. It's not an election, it's a meeting, usually of a political party, to conduct specific business. State law requires that caucuses are held every 2 years, not 4. The presidential preference poll is actually the only part that doesn't happen at every caucus. Regular caucus functions, presidential year or not, include electing representatives to have voting rights on the county party's central committee and signing up interested participants as delegates to the party conventions. Representation on the central committee is limited to as few as 2 members from each precinct. The lucky few who are elected as delegates to the Republican National Convention are chosen at their district convention, where delegate slots are awarded on a first-come, first-served basis, beginning with those who signed up and paid their fees at the caucus. It is possible for an interested person to be elected to the Central Committee or sign up as a convention delegate after Monday night's precinct caucuses. By the time they do, though, those positions could already be filled by someone who is present at the caucus. So interested caucus-goers, even those who receive and cast a ballot for the presidential poll, could still, unfortunately, lose out on multiple opportunities to get involved if denied entry to their precinct caucus due to capacity limits. Even those who intend only to cast a presidential vote won't get the chance to address their caucus in support of their chosen candidate or hear other candidate speeches at all. Nor will a caucus goer who is denied entry to get to observe the counting of the ballots, outlined in Iowa Code 43.4. It poses a conundrum for Republicans in Iowa's second largest county. What outcome should we hope for? Record turnout of enthusiastic participants, some of whom are shut out and disenfranchised, or full participation at a smooth caucus because of a more manageable, meaning smaller, turnout? The question could be rendered moot by weather. It is heckin' cold outside, but I know better than to underestimate the political passion of Iowans. And unlike 2016 and 2020, when our Democratic counterparts had big presidential contests of their own, Left-wing progressive could see more opportunity this time in registering as a Republican just to vote at their local GOP caucus. Yes, they'd give up their right to participate in this year's Iowa Democratic Party mail-in balloting snooze fest, but nobody is expecting a surprise upset of Joe Biden if participation in Iowa wilts. Hayes acknowledged that the county GOP's attendance projections were based on the number of already registered Republicans in each precinct, without considering non-party or Democratic voters who register to participate with the GOP. If a lot of them come in and come over, we will be swamped, Hayes said at the December meeting. We will be absolutely swamped, and I'm thinking it's looking that way. Safety notwithstanding, I don't find it wise for a county party leader to emphasize capacity limits over other obligations necessary to run a smooth caucus. But I can't change the decision-making. What I can do is offer advice to those planning to attend Monday night's GOP caucus so those who want to fully participate can. Don't assume that your caucus is at the same place you normally vote. Most Republicans will caucus elsewhere than their Election Day polling place. Know your precinct. You'll need to find the location of your caucus and where to check in once you arrive. Visit iowagop.org/2024caucus to find your precinct name and location. Most Linn County GOP caucus sites will host multiple precincts. You can only caucus in the precinct where you reside. Arrive as early as you can. It'll help you avoid being shut out if and when a site leader halts entry. Bring ID. The Iowa GOP instituted the same ID requirements as regular polling places. If your voter registration needs updating, you'll also need to prove your new address. If it's listed on your driver's license, great. If not, try a utility bill, bank statement, residential lease, pay stub, or other government check with your name and new address. Consider your last registration update. The state party gives each precinct a paper list of registered Republicans in that precinct. Furnishing paper lists of nearly 600,000 active GOP voters across precincts in 99 counties requires a very early start to the printing process. If you updated your registration only within the last month, on or after December 15th, assume that your precinct does not have your updated registration. Expedite the line by having your forms ready. And if you wish to submit a resolution to the Republican Party platform, try writing it in advance. If you want to sign up for the conventions or the Central Committee but were denied entry, tell the organizer who provides your ballot your intentions and stick around near the area. And finally, be patient with your caucus organizers and friendly with your precinct. Caucuses require incredible amounts of volunteer work and coordination. It's part of the charm of our process and our people. Even when we disagree on how best to do it, we're still going to show up, get to work, and see this thing through. And we better, the whole country's watching. Todd Dorman writes in his 24-hour Dorman column, "Will the abominable Trump cruise in the caucuses?" It will be a cold day in Iowa before Republican caucus-goers put a corrupt authoritarian who tried to overturn a lawful election back on a path to the White House. On caucus day Monday, high temperatures will be below zero over much of Iowa. Uh-oh, cold enough for you? Yes, former President Donald Trump is a heavy favorite to win Iowa. His polling lead seems as insurmountable as the contentions of his backers that the FBI was behind the Capitol riot, the 2020 election was stolen, and he was a great president. The only real question is, how big will Trump's win be? Will Florida Governor Ron DeSantis run a respectable second place, giving him enough momentum to soldier on? Will former South Carolina Governor and UN Ambassador Nikki Haley do well enough to gain speed going into the New Hampshire primary, where she trails old 91 felony counts by just 11 points, according to polling averages? Will the cold freeze turn out? Will bored Democrats crash the Republicans' party? Or will Trump win Iowa handily, win New Hampshire, and go on to become the GOP standard bearer between court dates? If TV ads are a guide, the whole thing has come down to Tricky Nicky, Dumpster Fire Ron, and the dictator of national chaos. Quite the murderer's row. Haley terrifies me the least, not much of an endorsement. The DeSantis campaign slide into the ditch may become legendary. He was supposed to be the LGBTQ-loathing, woke-mind-virus-fighting, sunshine state authoritarian who would become heir to the Trump legacy, but without the former president's cargo ship filled with baggage. He has the support of some of Iowa's top Republican leaders. Governor Kim Reynolds endorsed DeSantis, as did evangelical kingmaker Bob Vanderplatz, State Senate President Amy Sinclair, House Majority Leader Matt Winchell, Senate Majority Whip Waylon Brown, House Majority Whip Henry Stone, and Speaker Pro Tem John Wills all endorsed DeSantis, as did a lengthy list of other Republican state senators and representatives. So the kingmakers came for the king and appear to have missed. An Iowa poll released in December found 54% of Republicans said Reynolds' endorsement didn't matter, and Vanderplatz's endorsement didn't matter to 73% of Republicans surveyed. "He's a wounded bird falling from the sky," Trump said of DeSantis, waxing almost poetic. "I wonder what position Kim was promised in order to back someone who is so far down in the polls." This isn't much of a surprise. For one thing, endorsements historically haven't carried much weight in the caucuses. Voters who get to see the candidates repeatedly don't need poobahs to tell them how to vote. In 2004, Democrat Howard Dean had endorsements from Al Gore and Tom Harkin in his pocket. He still finished third. It's enough to make you scream. Second, and more importantly, Reynolds and other top Iowa Republicans have worked overtime for the better part of 6 years, making Iowa the Trumpiest state in Trump country. The governor was honored to receive Trump's endorsement for re-election in 2022. She marched in lockstep with Trump through all the lies, impeachments, and recklessness. On the day after the Capitol riot, Reynolds said, "You know what we need to do is stop pointing fingers, and we need to move forward." Before Reynolds endorsed DeSantis in November, Trump criticized the governor for her neutrality in the caucus campaign. "I opened up the governor position for Kim Reynolds, and when she fell behind, I endorsed her, did big rallies, and she won," Trump truthed on Truth Social in July. "Now she wants to remain neutral. I don't invite her to events." "To be quite honest, he is one of the most effective leaders I have ever seen," Reynolds said as she endorsed DeSantis. "We need someone who will fight for you and win for you, someone who won't get distracted but will stay disciplined, who puts his country first and not himself. That leader is Ron DeSantis. Someone who didn't turn out to be weirdly awkward and unlikable would have been nice, too." Trump's campaign fired back with Trumpian flair. Kim Reynolds apparently has begun her retirement tour early, as she clearly does not have any ambition for higher office, a Trump campaign statement read. Earlier this year, she promised her constituents that she would remain neutral in the race, yet she has completely gone back on that promise. Regardless, her endorsement will not make any difference in this race. This will be a fascinating story moving forward. If Trump wins the nomination, and God forbid the presidency, how will he regard Iowa and its governor? Surely Trump will bury the hatchet, let bygones be bygones, and turn the other cheek. Okay, probably not. If he wins big Monday, be sure to stay up and tune into his victory speech. It ought to be something. Reynolds and other Republicans were right to urge Republicans to move on from Trump. But anyone who watches movies knows that eventually, monsters created will turn on their creators. As Doc Frankenstein, technical support for the HAL 900, and all the people who get eaten in Jurassic Park learned the hard way. Iowa Republicans helped create the abominable Trump. Now he thrives in the cold. Today's editorial cartoon from cartoonist Joe Heller from the Green Bay area is an outline of a January calendar with letters in each square reading, "How long the month seems if your NFL team isn't going to the 2024 playoffs." And our community letters today, the first from James Townsend, DDS, LTC, retired U.S. Army Dental Corps of Cedar Falls. "Haley is a clear choice for caucus voters. Are you tired of choosing from the best of the worst? Well, you won't have to anymore with Nikki Haley as a Republican candidate at the caucuses on January 15th or the general election on November 5th for president. The polls have Nikki defeating Biden by 17% while DeSantis doesn't beat him at all. The reasons for why Nikki will make the best new conservative candidate choice are simple: her integrity, her deep-rooted faith, and her pro-life, pro-gun, pro-police stances. She'll take on fixing our broken immigration system with dignity and care, but yet opposing open borders, and deal with her economic problems not by raising taxes, but by reducing the debt by holding politicians accountable. She is opposed to expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act and wants to rebuild our military forces until we were strong enough to oppose war by strength. How can all that be done? With her energy, motivation, and experience as governor of South Carolina and United Nations ambassador, she can represent our country with dignity and still get the job done. It's a clear choice. Vote for Nikki Haley at Monday's GOP caucuses." James Townsend, DDS, retired U.S. Army Dental Corps, Cedar Falls. Next, Joe Miller of Cedar Rapids writes, "Weather perfectly timed to caucuses. Our big snowfall is fitting right in with a big snow job we're getting from all the candidates. I just wish it could all be plowed to the curb." Joe Miller of Cedar Rapids. Next, Brenda Sandberg of Atkins writes, "DeSantis dedication versus Haley's disdain. We're just days away from the Iowa caucuses where we will kick off the GOP primary and begin narrowing the field. For decades, Iowans have taken the responsibility of being the first nominating contest in the nation seriously. It's a point of pride. When so many politicians ignore us in the flyover states, the Iowa caucus gives us a voice. But presidential candidate Nikki Haley obviously does not respect Iowa or our role in the process. She laughed along with the crowd of her supporters in New Hampshire that she's trusting them to correct the results of the Iowa caucuses. This is another sign that she not only doesn't care about Iowa, she seems to prefer we didn't exist. While she's dismissing us in New Hampshire and acting like Iowa doesn't matter, Ron DeSantis has taken the time to visit all of Iowa's 99 counties. He's a true conservative that shares our values and cares about Iowa. Since Governor Kim Reynolds has thrown her support behind DeSantis, I think we should all strongly stand behind him as the best candidate to get things done in Washington. Nikki showed her true colors. Now we know what Nikki Haley really thinks about Iowa. It's simple, really. Haley's contempt for Iowa and her liberal values should be totally disqualifying for any Iowan considering supporting her. Brenda Sandberg of Atkins. Bill Shetler of Mount Vernon writes, 2023 was a good year for President Biden. Attend your Iowa caucus Monday, January 15th. Thank God and Joe Biden for a great 2023 with 2.7 million jobs created, the highest Dow Jones and S&P 500 records in history. Our American economy is doing its best ever for retiree investments. Gas at Costco was $2.71 a gallon, steady for months. Bill Shetler of Mount Vernon. And finally, Linda Stickle of Anamosa writes, Vivek appeals to all demographics. On Monday, Iowans get to voice who we want to lead this nation. Few others get that chance. It should be a sobering decision to choose the best person for the job. This is indeed a weight on our shoulders as we face what could be the end of America as we know it. Will my grandkids shoulder enormous debt brought on by people they never knew? Will they be sent off to die in some war by someone who profits from the bloodshed of others? Vivek Ramaswamy has sound America First principles. He believes in much of what our original founders believed: merit, hard work, faith, small government, and capitalism. He appeals to all demographics. That means he can win, and we are done if we don't win. Vivek has the intellect to fight our ghost enemies, tech, banking, and pharma, from the inside. We can't continue to play catch-up for decades or find ourselves in a social credit world like communist China. He literally wrote the book on woke. He will fire 75% of bureaucrats and eliminate the agencies that have been weaponized against us. His domestic and foreign policies will put America first and keep our descendants in a stable world. His list of proposed federal judges has been called brilliant. Vivek has the unique skill to solve the problems of today. I will be caucusing for him January 15th and ask you to do the same. Linda Stickle of Anamosa. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, January 14th, 2024, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I am your reader, Sharon Falgido, reading from a digital copy of the newspaper today because I totally understand why I would not have a physical newspaper delivered. It is very, very cold and snowy outside. We turn to today's obituaries. A couple of other notices. First, Ricky Lee Marlatt, age 81, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, January 12th. Brosh Chaplin, the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, handling arrangements. And Brad Olson, age 67, of Newhall, died January 11th. Funeral services pending with Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton. Deanna Barvinick, known as Susie, age 82, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on January 9th at the Northbrook Healthcare Center. Graveside services will be 12 p.m. Saturday, April 20th, at Czech National Cemetery, followed by a celebration of life gathering from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, April 20th, at the Ava Center at Brosh Chapel, located at 2021 Bowling Street Southwest. Susie enjoyed a successful career as a paralegal at the law firm of Dunbaugh, Guts, Booth, and Gross, later retiring from Moyer and Bergman. Outside of work, Susie was a dedicated wife, mother, grandmother, sister, aunt, cousin, and genuine friend. She loved to camp, bake, and cherished spending time with family. Gerald E. Sperry, age 96, of Cedar Rapids, passed away January 9th. Visitation, 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, January 20th, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Funeral service, 11 a.m. Saturday, January 20th, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Interment, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Gerald served his country in the United States Army in World War II, being stationed in Korea. Gerald worked in several capacities at Iowa Steel and Iron Works in Cedar Rapids, where his final and favorite job was site electrician. Gerald retired from Iowa Steel in 1984, and he and Ella began their retirement years as they spent countless hours loving their grandchildren, helping their adult children with household projects, and making annual winter treks to Laughlin, Nevada, and Bullhead City, Arizona, where they enjoyed the sunshine and the ability to be outside in the warm weather. Norman J. Stevenson of Cedar Rapids passed away January 7th at the Oldorf Hospice House. There will be no funeral or visitation. Burial will be held in Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. He was a member of Antioch Christian Church. Gail Vitito, age 69, of Belle Plain, died January 9th. Private services have been held. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids assisted the family. Gail worked in retail and loved working with customers. She was an incredibly strong woman with a contagious laugh. She was a loving mother and grandmother who cherished time spent with her family. Velma Mae Stone LeClaire Jensen, age 100, of Coggan, passed away January 6th at the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester. A celebration of Velma's life will be held later in the spring at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 27th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Central City, where the family will greet friends from 10 a.m. until the service time on Saturday. Pastor Sherry Anderson will officiate. Interment will follow at Spring Grove Cemetery in Coggan. Velma owned and operated her own beauty salon. Most recently, she worked for Rockwell Collins until her retirement in 1985. She loved camping, fishing, and crocheting, and in her later years, enjoyed coloring. Velma was a member of the United Parish Church in Coggan and former member of the Eastern Star Lodge in Coggan. Gary Allen Holub, age 73, of Cedar Rapids, died January 8th with his wife by his side. Funeral Mass, 10 a.m. Friday, January 19th at St. Matthew Catholic Church by Reverend Douglas Locke. Burial, Czech National Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family on Friday after 9 a.m. at the church. There will be lunch served at the church after the burial. TN Funeral Home is serving the family. Larry L.D. Becker, age 81, of Enid, Oklahoma, formerly of Manchester, passed away on January 3rd following a lengthy struggle with COPD. Larry enlisted in the United States Air Force in 1961 and served at Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota in the payroll division until his honorable discharge in October of 1968. After his service, Larry returned to Manchester, where he was employed at the Marion Post Office and then worked as a welder at Henderson Manufacturing Company in Manchester. In 1978, Larry moved to Enid, Oklahoma, where he was employed at Failing Company as a welder until his retirement. Public graveside service with military rites, 11 a.m. Saturday, January 20th, at St. Mary Catholic Church, Catholic Cemetery in Manchester, with Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Interment, 11 a.m. Saturday, January 20th, St. Mary Catholic Cemetery in Manchester. Cora Cooks, age 85, of Cedar Rapids, closed her eyes here and opened them in heaven on Sunday, January 7th. Services will be held on Saturday, January 20th, 1 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Visitation will be Friday, January 19th, 4 to 7 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Funeral Home. Burial, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Cora was an interior decorator for home interiors. She was a loving wife and mother who took great pride in caring for her grandchildren and great-grandchildren and will be dearly missed. Cora was a devoted mother who could be heard cheering, "That's my baby," at each of her son's sporting events. Cora will be remembered for her loving, gentle spirit and boisterous laugh. She lived and taught her children integrity, kindness, and strength in the face of adversity. Living by Joshua 24:15, Cora created a loving home with open doors to her many nieces and nephews, and they will always remember the many fishing trips in the camper with her and their Uncle Al. Patricia L. Powers, age 87, of Tipton, died January 9th at Cedar Manor Nursing Home in Tipton following a brief illness. Services, 10:30 a.m. January 18th, St. Mary's Catholic Church in Tipton. Burial, St. Mary's Cemetery. The Reverend Father James Flattery will officiate the services. Family and friends may call from 2 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, January 17th at the Fry Funeral Home in Tipton, where parish rosary will be held at 7 p.m. She was a lifelong partner in the Farm and New Liberty Elevator. She spent her life serving others, working in local hospitals, nursing homes, and Bennett Community School. She served as an EMT for Bennett Ambulance for 10 years, as a Cedar County Board of Health member for 18 years. She was a St. Mary's Parish member for 62 years and the president and officer in the Davenport Diocese Council of Catholic Women. Stephen G. Rosenberger of Waldenburg passed peacefully into eternity on January 8th at his home with his wife of 39 years and his brother by his side. He had struggled with Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia since 2010, enduring a stroke in 2023, and had recently been bedridden with colorectal cancer. He was an employee of the City of Cedar Rapids Street Department for 42 years until ill health forced early retirement. Steve's passions in life were family, friends, pets, baseball, cycling, and coaching and mentoring youth. In final years, he was an avid pickleball enthusiast with his best friend, Stan Wiebold. Kloster Funeral Home of Marengo is caring for Steve and his family. Honoring his wishes, there will be no visitation or funeral services. A celebration of Steve's life is being planned for June. Turning to the sports page, in women's basketball, the Cyclones knock off another ranked opponent And although the Iowa game was past the publication time for this, I can tell you that the Iowa women also won last night. The Crooks scores 23 points as ISU upends number 4 Baylor. By Rob Gray, correspondent in Ames. Bill Fennelly trotted toward the locker room with his arms raised high, fist pumping as the relatively small but hearty Hilton Coliseum crowd roared. Iowa State's veteran head coach basked in the moment after his Cyclones upended number 4 Baylor, 66-63 on a snow-swept Saturday afternoon, then emphatically swung his arm toward the rafters, leaving the floor with a remarkably swift gait. "I don't think there's any doubt that the most important people in the building today were the fans," said Fennelly, whose young team knocked off a top 25 foe twice in 1 week for the first time since 2010. "I told the players before the game we wanted to do two things. Number one, make sure the people walked out of here saying it was worth coming, and number two, the people that couldn't make it would say, 'Dang, I wish I would have been there for that one.' I think we did both." ISU, 12-4, 5-0 in the Big 12, accomplished those ambitious twin goals despite falling behind 24-11 at the end of the first quarter. The Bears, 14-2, 3-2, banked in a 55-footer to beat the buzzer, and after 10 minutes, the Cyclones faced a double-digit hole for the second consecutive game. And just like against number 24 West Virginia, they surged back for the win. Fennelly's message, "Let's just say it was a wake-up," said freshman center Audie Crooks, who scored 23 points in 26 minutes while battling late foul trouble. In the huddles and in the locker room, he really emphasized how important the fans were tonight. "They found a way to get here. They found a way to cheer. I mean, they were the difference in this game." So was Crooks, whom Baylor coach Nikki Collins said her team had no answer for. So was senior transfer guard Hannah Bellinger, who Colleen deemed the game's difference maker. "She's the one we thought we could guard and didn't guard well enough," Collins said. Bellinger finished with 15 points on 5 of 8 shooting, including a 3 of 4 mark from 3-point range. "Coach Fennelly always preaches to be ready when your opportunity is up," Bellinger said. ISU used a 10-2 run in the second quarter to trim Baylor's edge to 3 points at 28-25, but the Bears closed the first half with a 7-2 splurge to lead 37-29 at the break. The Cyclones committed 10 turnovers in the first quarter, but lost just 11 in the ensuing 30 minutes and took their first lead at 61-59 on a Crooks layup with 3:17 left. Baylor inched back ahead 64-63 with 31 seconds left, but another Crooks layup and a pair of Bellinger free throws essentially sealed ISU's fifth straight triumph. "Hannah Bellinger was phenomenal tonight," Fennelly said, "so the team's an interesting mix. And our team, we said from the beginning, this team is not going to be aesthetically probably fun to watch, but they're going to be fun to watch because they're going to play their you-know-whats off, and that's kind of been what they're doing." Freshman forward Addie Brown scored just 2 points in the first half, but finished with 9 points, 11 rebounds, 5 assists, and a career-high 6 steals. She narrowly missed recording her 8th double-double of the season. Fennelly simply had to display exuberance once those 2 pregame goals were fully met and his team celebrated at midcourt. "I don't take this crowd for granted, I promise you," an emotional Fennelly said. In Iowa football analysis, re-recruiting success. Retention of key players sets up Iowa's defense for potentially more success in 2024, by John Stepp of the Gazette in Iowa City. During a month of December, when each day carries value in the transfer portal, Iowa football coaches could have told their players with extra eligibility that we need a decision by X date. That way, Iowa can go to the portal, recruiting director Tyler Barnes explained hypothetically last month. But instead, Iowa invested its resources closer to home on the several Hawkeye players who face stay-or-go decisions. "We want all these kids back," Barnes said at the time. "They're 4th, 5th, 6th-year guys on our team. It's well worth investing the time to recruit these guys back before we even think about going to the portal." Iowa's investment in re-recruiting its own roster, intangibly with time and literally with NIL resources, has yielded some impressive results, particularly on the defensive side of the ball. Iowa's defense, which led the country for the second consecutive season with only 4.08 yards allowed per play and thrived in many other metrics as well, is expected to return a rare amount of experience in 2024. It started with linebacker Jay Higgins, the leading tackler among Power 5 conferences, when he announced his plan to stay for his extra COVID-19 year of eligibility. Fellow linebacker Nick Jackson and defensive backs Sebastian Castro, Jamari Harris, and Quinn Schulte later made similar decisions to stay in Iowa City for 2024. That's in addition to, on the other side of the ball, tight end Luke Lachey's decision not to pursue the NFL draft and offensive lineman Nick DeJean's decision to use his extra COVID-19 year. As a result, 8 of Iowa's 11 starters from last year's defense are expected to return. DeShaun Lee, while not a starter for most of Iowa's games, adds to that number after starting 6 times at cornerback as a replacement for either Harris or Cooper DeJean. Linebacker Kyle Fisher has not made an official announcement about his 2024 plans, but he is expected to return, likely giving the Hawkeyes a 10th defensive player with at least some starting experience. That adds up to 192 career starts by Iowa defensive players who are expected to wear black and gold again in 2024. Five defensive players will begin the 2024 season with at least 15 career starts, compared to only two at the beginning of the 2023 season. The current numbers come with the caveat that circumstances in January are not always the same circumstances in August. The spring transfer portal window will be from April 16th to 30th, and some attrition is likely. I have a whole spreadsheet based on the attrition we've had from fall all the way through next fall, and history would tell you we typically lose 4 to 5 guys in the spring, Barnes said last month. The first transfer portal window closed earlier this month, limiting new portal entries to those who already graduated or are at a program that changed head coaches. The portal windows do not preclude Iowa, or any other school, from adding players already in the portal. Iowa coach Ferentz said last month the Hawkeyes will keep an eye out on the portal. While the defense appears to be already in great shape for 2024, lingering positional needs for Iowa include wide receiver and backup quarterback. Tracking portal activity can be an inexact science because it is not publicly visible, but the recruiting site ON3's database suggests more than half of the 2,102 portal entries this year have not chosen a new home yet. Top-level talent is less likely to be among the 1,100-plus available players, but Iowa has previously shown the ability to find quality additions later in the offseason. Key commitments last year, such as Jackson and offensive lineman Rusty Feth, both were after the first 22-23 portal window closed. Ex-Ohio State wide receiver Caleb Brown did not commit until the spring portal window. Iowa's crowded scholarship situation could serve as an obstacle to the Hawkeyes' portal involvement. Iowa's impressive self-recruitment leaves the Hawkeyes with 90 scholarship players on the roster. Iowa must whittle that number to 85 by the fall, which could happen via departing transfers during the second portal window or medical scholarships. We're going to continue to monitor things, and it will be fluid, Barnes said regarding the scholarship situation last month. We'll kind of see where the chips fall. And the Time Machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa, the Elkader Opera House. 1903 building has had many uses, including stint as a fire station. By Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent in Elkader. Frank E. Long's stock company packed up after performing in Cresco on August 14, 1901, and left for Elkader to perform Peaceful Valley, the first performance at the new Turner Hall Opera House on August 16. The Turner Opera House had a short life. A fire caused by a defective furnace flue leveled it February 5, 1903. The splendid system of waterworks, CRIC, was all that saved the business portion of the town from destruction, the Gazette reported. Damage was estimated at $8,000, about $288,000 today. Insurance covered $4,900, or $176,340 today. The fire left the community without a public hall, and the public response was immediate. Among the fundraisers, an October 1st carnival on the Elkader Fairgrounds. The new Elkader Opera House cost $16,000, about $500,000 in today's dollars, and was designed to seat 600, but can be crowded to seat 800, according to news reports. It featured a ruby glass chandelier and a horseshoe balcony that was one of only two thought to exist in the United States at the time. The grand opening, November 27, 1903, was attended by about 750, 55 of whom came from special train from McGregor. The opening show was The Governor's Son, George M. Cohan's first Broadway musical. It was a three-act comedy about guests at a country resort. Performing with Cohan were Helen, Jerry, and Josephine Cohan, Ethel Levy, and Ned Wayburn. The Opera House was part of the Chicago-Minneapolis vaudeville circuit and soon acquired the sobriquet Little Broadway. During the Depression, the Elkader Town Council and City Library moved into the Opera House in August 1930. The original City Hall was remodeled as a place for paving crews to stay of a construction camp. In May 1938, Elkader held its first fish supper in the basement of the Opera House. More than 260 guests filled five long tables and consumed 250 pounds of catfish, 40 loaves of bread, 25 pounds of butter, 10 gallons of ice cream, and enough coffee to float a battleship, according to the Postville Herald. The building hosted many public meetings and also housed a dance hall and a gymnasium, where Golden Gloves boxing matches were held in the 1940s. In 1943, the theater was remodeled with the city's fire station on the first floor and the public library under the balcony. In 1962, the Opera House underwent extensive restoration and renovation. It started when a women's club held a meeting in the building, and the members noticed the walls were darkened by smoke from the coal furnace. Plaster was hanging from the ceiling, and the building was suffering from general deterioration. Volunteers decided to restore the Opera House as an opera house. The main floor and horseshoe balcony were painted white, silver, red, and gold, accented with black and gold stencil trim. News clippings about the Opera House were placed in ornate frames and hung on the walls. An asbestos curtain company displaying community advertising from 1903 was found in the attic, cleaned, restored, and rehung on the stage. The large ruby chandelier that once graced the building was duplicated and rehung. The playbills pasted on the back walls remained. The curtain will open on the nearly completed project November 14th for the annual show of the Elkader Chapter of the Society for Preservation and Encouragement, a barbershop quartet singing in America, the Gazette reported. The restored Opera House, placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1976, became the home for the Keystone Chorus Barbershop Chorus, the Fine Arts Council of Elkader, and the Opera House Players. It underwent a $600,000 renovation beginning in 2001 and finishing in 2003, the building's centennial year. Money for the project came from donations, fundraising, and a Vision Iowa Community Attraction and Tourism grant. A new grand staircase was added, as well as a new sound system, a handicap-accessible entrance and restrooms, and a new stage curtain. The Opera House was rededicated November 27th to 29th, 2003. The Opera House Players performed The Governor's Son, the house's first production in 1903, in recognition of the anniversary. The Opera House is still going strong. Recent events included an October 2023 production of the musical Peter Pan and a classic Christmas fantasy concert by the Opera House Players in December. That brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, January 14th, 2004. I have selected and lightly edited the articles for the last reading. My name is Sharon Faldudo. I am reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville, where my poor dog struggled outside in the snow, and I hope she's okay now. She is inside again. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other recording from Iris at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We welcome your comments, and thank you for listening.